So this morning, we invited this amazing group of people. As you can clearly tell, they are extreme professionals in their field. They know about mental health. And so what we did was we compiled a list of questions that we felt we needed to lean into and learn. So I encourage you this morning, get your notes out, whether it's on your phone or a notebook, take good notes, because there is a treasure of information up here awaiting us. I want to start with Dr. Buchan's first. From a clinical perspective, what are the most common mental health struggles you are seeing right now, and are you seeing an increase?
Thank you very much, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the welcome, warm welcome that you all gave me this morning, so thank you. To your question, I would say that really the most common issues that bring people to clinical attention really hasn't changed all that much over the years. It might look a little bit different just because, you know, we're in an era with lots of different stresses than we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But generally, the most common things are anxiety and depression. And anxiety and depression are much more common than I think people realize. There certainly is a difference between normal stress, normal sadness, normal anxiety about things. What differentiates between normal and something that might need clinical attention, though, tends to be how long something is going on, how intense the feelings might be, and probably the biggest one is how much is it impacting somebody's day-to-day functioning? Are they able to do the things that they normally need to do or want to do? So to answer your question, that I would say anxiety and depression are really the biggest things out there.
Wow. Thank you for answering that. That was great. Ashley, how are our spiritual life and mental health connected?
Yeah, thanks, Josh. So I firmly believe that our spiritual life and our mental health are very interconnected.
Is your mic on? There you go.
Can you hear me now? So I very much believe that our mental health and our spiritual life are very interconnected, in part because our mind, body, and soul are all part of a holistic framework that the Lord designed. And so in order to be able to connect to what I kind of like to call our spirit-led selves, which is at the very center of ourselves, we have to be able to get to know and engage with our physical, our mental, and our emotional and spiritual selves, to be able to become a connection and alignment with those, to be able to access our center-most spirit-led self.
Thank you for that. That's great. Doreen, how does unaddressed emotional pain affect a marriage?
So to answer my questions today, I want to put a foundation that I use, kind of, and then I'll do this quickly and jump into marriage. It's so interesting you use that verse, because that is actually a foundational verse that I think from and move from, but I want to couple it with what Jesus said in Mark 8:36, and he said, what does it profit a person if he gains the entire world but loses his soul? A lot of times we think of that through the eternal part of us, but actually that is the exact same Greek word that John used to his friend when he said, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. John was not referencing eternity there. Neither was Jesus only. It's not incorrect, it's just incomplete. So when I break down soul, it's going to kind of weave into what they've already said. It can be a blend of the mind, emotions, and this is where I'm going to stretch you a little bit, affections and desires, imaginations, and then the will. And so the reason those other things are in there is we often talk about affections and desires being wrong, but God talks about them in a good way. It's what draws us to things. It's what draws you here. Your desire to grow in the Lord drew you here this morning, or to support each other, or to serve, or whatever it was, okay? Imaginations can be fear that got out of hand, and we live in because I work in anxiety a lot, a world that feels real to us, but it may not actually be completely accurate to facts, okay? Or imaginations is actually what drives us to entrepreneurship. We think beyond. It's what starts new ministries, new churches, whatever, okay? All of that compasses. So when we get to couple care, where was I going with this? Oh, unaddressed emotional pain. You have to sort through where this comes from, because sometimes our affections make us feel guilty, and then, or sometimes, you know, it just goes on and on and on. So that's actually kind of why I break down and go through the soul. Now, when emotions are generating from beliefs, okay, I'm not talking about God beliefs right now, I'm talking about self-beliefs. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. I'm not valuable. I'm not lovable. All the negative items. When I say negative, I don't mean it's bad. It's just real. Usually those came somewhere from trauma. And it could be trauma in childhood. Now I want to say what I mean by trauma. I don't mean you even necessarily were abused. It was the experience you had as a child and how you perceived it from a child lens. And it repeatedly kept coming in the door. And eventually we develop a self-belief about that, which could be, I'm not lovable, I'm not good enough, I'm not valuable, I'm not worthy. Those generate in the soul, and it begins to shape the lens how I interpret everything else. So when we get to couples, it can trigger very big, like, trying to think how to succinctly do this. Anyway, it triggers a deep sense of something's distressed, in distress within me. And what was said and what we hear internally can be very different. And so that is kind of the dance I do with couples. Meaning I work on that dance and figure out, try to unpack that a little bit. And then figure out whether we have to heal the brain, the memory system, or we have to heal the mind system, or what I believe about me.
That's great. Thank you for that. That was really helpful, the foundation you laid there. Dr. Buchans, how can someone tell the difference between normal stress, sadness, and something like anxiety or depression that may need some professional help?
Thank you, Josh. Yeah, I was kind of getting to that answer in my first answer to your question. So really the thing that I look for when I'm trying to help somebody determine exactly that, how much of is what you're going through just normal reaction to the stressors that are going on in life versus this is something that we need to do more than just kind of wait and see what's going on here. And it really is, how much is it impacting somebody on a day-to-day basis? And how long have those difficult symptoms, whatever they might be, been impacting somebody's day-to-day functioning? So I really look at those two domains. What I would advise people is, if you have any question about it, if you're just not feeling like yourself, if you're not feeling like, you know, this is the way that I think I ought to be, thinking about things or going through life, forget about trying to figure out, is this, you should just ask for help. You should go to somebody, tell somebody you trust, you know, what's going on, and indeed seek professional help, somebody who is trained to ask the questions, to kind of observe how, what your demeanor is, and really listen to everything that you've been going through to really help kind of determine what things might be helpful to you moving forward.
That's great. Thank you for that. Ashley, what are some unhealthy messages Christians sometimes believe about mental health?
So I've grown up in the church, and I have heard positive messages, but I've also heard a lot of unhealthy messages throughout my development. And I kind of narrowed them down to three. Of course, there's more than that. But the three that I narrowed them down to are one, that when you're dealing with mental health symptoms, it's because you don't lack faith. That is not, absolutely not true. Two is that when you're dealing with mental health symptoms, it's always a direct result from demonic interference. I'm not discrediting that can be a factor at times, but that's not always the case. And then the third one is that we tend to believe, I've heard it many times, that if you seek out professional help, whether that be therapy or medication management, more often medication, that you're not receptive to healing from the Lord and from the Spirit.
Wow.
And for me, a foundational belief I hold, not only with mental health, but with physical health as well, is that if we limit our belief that the Holy Spirit can only move in divine healings, then, you know, what are we saying about God and about God's capabilities? God created, you know, the people that have developed therapy, that have developed medications to help us. And so who am I to say that the Lord can't divinely intervene and that the Spirit can't move through therapy and medicine as well?
That's right. That's good. Love that. Doreen, what are some common communication mistakes that couples make when one spouse is struggling mentally or emotionally?
There's a difference between someone having a pervasive struggle in mental and emotional, like they're severely depressed for a long period of time or have been in trauma for a long period of time, as opposed to when you go through a situational experience and we just lost a loved one. And so we're depressed, we feel, you know, and all that, but it's situational. Okay, so it's probably, I want to clarify this. I don't actually work as much in the deeper mental health stuff. I'm somewhere between, though I'm trained in it, I'm somewhere between that group and pastors. I don't know how else to say it, okay?
Because, good.
I can go there and I know about it. I've been educated in it. It's not what I directly deal with because I deal with the blend. I deal with a lot of couples, but I deal with, that's a bad way of saying it. I get the opportunity to journey with them. Let me reframe that. But I don't actually walk with as many with deep mental health stuff as I do maybe situational mental health challenges, spiritual challenges, physical challenges. And I want to just drop something in here for a minute. Chronic physical illness is huge for a couple. I've had walked with several very young couples. When I say young, I'm talking in their 20s, where one of them had a very chronic illness.
Wow.
That isolates them a ton because their peers are not dealing with it. They're dealing in struggles that nobody else is. They definitely need support because it is a very unique journey, especially in this day and age, for someone to be chronically physically ill, but then that generates sometimes to mental health challenges. Anyway, so I wanted to bring that up. But first of all, let me just say this. If, regardless of why your spouse is struggling, educate yourself as the non-struggling spouse or least struggling spouse. Educate yourself, but why, not just with Dr. Google, but like actually go to someone who understands it. If you can attend maybe the counseling, the therapist, the psychiatrist appointment, and your spouse is okay with it, go to that. But here's the deal. You're not going to become their therapist, counselor, or psychiatrist.
Come on.
Therein becomes the problem sometimes. And I'm going to say this to you men. I know you love to fix problems, but you will never be that for them. You have a role that only you can fill, and that is not that. I can fill it, my colleagues can fill it, but you can't. But none of the rest of us can fill the husband role. And that is to walk with them with grace and kindness, understanding, compassion, listening, and yes, maybe get your own support. You need some friends that you can kind of dump to and go like, this is hard, it is, okay? Now, I want to flip to the other side. If it's a woman and you have a mentally challenged man, sometimes you mother him, and that's not helpful, and educate yourself. You know, so there's all those complexities. Now, there's one other thing I wanted to say with chronic. I welcome in my office, if I've been working with an individual and I think the spouse should come in to learn more, I welcome it because I love educating. Education is not everything, but knowledge is helpful. It is not the full answer.
That's great.
So then we can come in and kind of help and I can bounce back and forth. And I enjoy it that way. But here's the other problem is sometimes, and I see this more with women, when they get ill, with something mental health is they want to be always catered to. So I work really hard to not let the mentally challenged person get in the center of the world and everybody dances around it. We got to figure out what can they give back, even if they're not super well. Anyway, so there's a lot to say there.
Oh, so good. Thank you for that. This next question is for Dr. Buchans, and I want to give some preface to it because it's on medication. And this was a question when we were Tim and I were prepping these that I was like really passionate about because I lost my dad 4 years ago. Many of you know that. And I started in this just deep grief process. I didn't really understand grief fully. And there was days where I just couldn't get by. And I remember going to my doctor and she said, hey, maybe you need some medication just to help. And as soon as she said that, I almost felt like this shame of like, well, if I take medication, I'm not believing God for support. And as Ashley said, it's a wrong belief. God has gifted doctors and medication to be able to help us. And so Dr. Buchans, there can sometimes be stigma around medication. Can you explain when medication is helpful and how it's meant to work?
Yeah, thank you, Josh. That's a great question and an important question because you're absolutely right. There is a stigma around medication, mental health generally, but medication specifically. And I do run into this all the time. And I think part of it is that there is just kind of an intrinsic natural belief that we have as humans that I shouldn't need something to be different than who I am, or there's a fear there that I'm going to take this and it's going to change who I am as a person. And I'm here to tell you that's not what the medicine is meant to do. It's most medicine doesn't do that. The way I like to explain it to my patients is that this medicine is a tool among a bunch of tools that we might have at our disposal to be helpful to you. And the purpose in our field of medication is really to lessen the intensity, lessen the duration of the problematic difficulties, problematic symptoms that are getting in the way of you being who you are, is kind of how I phrase it. Sometimes I will also use the analogy, because people are generally a lot more accepting of other medical interventions, things like taking antibiotics when you have an infection, or taking an asthma inhaler when you have asthma and you need something to help you breathe. I try to normalize psychiatric medication in the same realm. This is a medicine that is going to help reduce these difficult things that are getting in the way of you being the person you want to be.
Wow.
So that's generally how I think about it.
That's super helpful. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Ashley, this is another question. I'm so curious to hear the answer to this. Where is trauma stored in the body and how can we heal it?
So my answer for this is going to be a little longer than my other answers. And kind of jumping off Doreen earlier, first I want to define our terms on what trauma is, because I could explain all day long, but if we don't have the same terms, we're going to be thinking about different things. So for one, trauma is the emotional response to experiencing distressing events, especially when that's pervasive. The way I explain it to clients is that there are kind of two sectors of trauma. We have big T traumas, which if I were to list out, I'm not going to, but if I were to list out, you know, these things that we would categorize as big T traumas, just about everybody in the room here would be like, oh my gosh, yeah, if you went through that, yeah, that would be traumatic. But we also have what we call little T traumas, and those are more individualized, personalized, that something that I have, you know, repeatedly experienced and is distressing to me may not be distressing or produce the same bodily result as Dr. Buchans or Doreen or Josh here. And it's important to note that's what I'm saying when I'm talking about trauma, is that our body has a response. And it's trauma is actually stored throughout our body, and it's individualized in how it will feel. For, you know, it might feel, come up as a different part of my body than Josh here, where I would feel it. But universally, we know that it's connected to the vagus nerve, which is actually in our connected to our spinal cord right up here at the base of our neck. And that is the longest cranial nerve that communicates with the entire body. And so we know that that nerve there is what kind of takes in information and perceives information and then communicates to the body, this is how we're going to respond. So for example, I might be in a situation where someone else sitting next to me might be completely calm or at peace, but because silence, for example, has repeatedly been associated with a distressing event for me. My body does not feel at rest in silence. It doesn't feel safe in silence. And it feels ready to be on defense. So the vagus nerve is what communicates to our body, hey, we can be at rest in this moment. We are safe. And or, you know, we need to be ready to be on the defense, to go and keep ourselves protected. So it's stored throughout our body, but we know it's centralized and stored in the nervous system. And ways to start that healing practice is foundationally with mindfulness, with being drawing attention and noticing in ourselves, you know, where are we experiencing this distressing feeling? And how can I bring myself back to a sense of homeostasis, a sense of safety? Because before we can talk about anything, do anything else, we need to be able to feel stable, secure, and safe. So that would be kind of the first thing, is beginning that mindful being connected to ourselves and noticing these things. And then also is connecting with a mental health professional, because there's, yes, talk therapy can be effective, but there's also trauma-specific modalities that don't require talking, that actually help the body reprocess trauma in a way that allows our nervous system to reset. And only trained professionals can engage in that.
So. That's great. Thank you for that answer. That was really, really helpful. Doreen, what would you say to the spouse who feels helpless watching their husband or wife struggle?
You know, because some, or are they with the right care person? You know, we're so diverse in the mental health. We really are. I mean, even people who trained in the exact same program I did, how they practice and the additional things they brought into their practice and their training really began to shape us different. So sometimes, first of all, if you've went to counseling or a therapist or something, you're like, yeah, I didn't like it, it didn't work. Well, keep trying. Because we are really, really different. We're a very, very diverse group. So just that point. But if they're struggling and they're seeing someone, see if you can go and join them at their counseling or therapy and see, is there anything we can do to help, or is it we missing something? So that's that thing. So there's that part. Some people, at times when I see someone and they're just stuck a lot, I'm like, there's a lot of different things I look at, but that's part of our role. Okay, does that make sense? Here's the other thing, though. This is the hidden part. And I bump into this with a couple therapy, actually not a lot with my group, because my group is pretty motivated to get to shift or heal or do whatever they have to do. But it can happen where the spouse is gaining, and I say this with great caution, is gaining something that they really want. So by not maybe be getting the proper not going and trying new things, or not getting medication, or not trying someone who actually works in the body, mind, brain health, in some of those modalities, they actually get the care they want from their spouse or family or loved ones. So I'm not saying they want to stay stuck. It's just a very deep embedded thing, you know? And so it's like, so I kind of look at that, but as a spouse, you can't judge that. Just get into a professional that can help discern and see if we can get that moving. But the other thing would be, I think what I answered earlier, get educated, get care, get people around you that can really help with that. And I just want to say this. The couples, I mentioned I don't work a lot in deep mental health, but one of the couple groups that I do sometimes get my door is adult ADHD, and they may or may not be medicated. That is, even if they're medicated, there's still some struggles. So we have to really focus in, you know, where one spouse, like, they're dropping all the balls all the time. Like, I carry the plates most of the time. They might carry them, they may not, I don't know. Okay, because they just got distracted. They were planning to do, but they didn't. The other one would be a little bit, some bipolar, and then high-functioning autism. I'm not advocating that I work in these, but I do have some clients like this. And so we have to put in life skills and ways that they're going to handle this, because it never goes away necessarily. We can just manage it better, and things like that. So that's big.
That's great. Thank you for that. Dr. Buchans, last question for you, and I'm really excited about this question for our young adults and youth in the room. What impact is AI and social media having on our mental health, And what trends are you seeing clinically because of it?
Yeah, that's a very great question and a hot question in the field. And the truth is, I don't know that we have the full answer just yet. I think we are all learning as we go. But what I can tell you is I think it's pretty clear that there are certainly positives and negatives with really any technology, and AI and social media are no different. Certainly some of the positives are that it increases access to information, it increases ability to stay connected with people over long distances, that kind of thing. But what I know that there is there's a the downside of it is that, and I see this especially among the younger people, they are increasingly relying on that screen, that phone, that tablet, that computer for their connection. And it's to the detriment of, I think, human connection, genuine human face-to-face, person-to-person connection. So I think that's one detriment. Another detriment in my mind is while all the information is really good, you have to be careful with that information because there is certainly a lot of misinformation out there. And while AI is getting better in leaps and bounds every day, it's still certainly not perfect. And one has to be very careful when you are using things or engaging in some kind of software that is AI or utilizes AI. You have to be careful with what it's feeding back to you. AI is also very good at reinforcing the things that you gravitate to naturally. And we've probably all experienced this, those of us that use Facebook. Facebook uses AI technology, and when you are like scrolling through the posts and you just linger over something for a little bit, it sees what you're lingering over, and then it feeds more posts that are like that. And then you almost get pigeonholed into certain information being fed to you, whether it's right or wrong. And it just, you have to be careful with that. Clinically, what I see as a result of really just technology use overall, especially in young people where there's not really good boundaries or limits being set by families, is that it has the potential to consume the young person, and they can almost get like an addiction to it, and it messes up their normal biorhythms, it messes up their normal ability to do the day-to-day things that we expect them to do, go to school, participate in family activities, participate in community activities. And all of those things then ultimately lead to things that disrupt their lives. It can lead to things like anxiety, it can lead to things like depression, which can also then lead to things like inability to focus on things that are very important or that I need to focus on. And so I would say that from a clinical standpoint, what I've generally been advising my patients and families is to indeed set healthy limits on how much technology you're using, what specifically you're using the technology for, and being very mindful of that, and really trying to encourage and express how important it is for the human connection.
Yeah.
You really need to have time and ability to interact with people face to face. We're human, and humans are wired.
Yeah, that's great. This is a curveball. So if you don't have an answer, that's totally fine. But as you were talking, it made me think of maybe some families in the room that maybe feel stuck. They don't know what to do. Their, you know, teenager child is connected to this digital technology. Is there any tools or resources that you have found really helpful that you recommend to parents?
That's a great question. I often refer my patients to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry webpage. They have an entire portfolio, essentially, that they call Facts for Families. And it's pretty much about any psychiatric or therapeutic topic that you can imagine. They have some kind of handout or sheet, like an explainer for families. And in those explainers, depending on the topic you're looking at, they will list various resources, both online and phone numbers that you can call to get maybe more local resources in your area. So that's generally where I send families to.
That's great. Thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ashley, last question. What is one practical thing everyone in this room can start doing this week for their mental health?
So this is something I tapped into earlier, and we've all kind of mentioned it briefly, but mindfulness. And when I'm saying mindfulness, what I am meaning is a self-awareness, a self-attunement. So a simple way to describe this is being aware of where our body is, where our emotions are, what our thoughts are. So a quick practice is, you know, when you're preparing for your quiet time in the morning, take, you know, a minute before you start and just sit with yourself. You know, what is my body feeling right now? What is it noticing around it? What are my five senses telling me? What thoughts am I noticing? It's really important to practice this without judgment, because, you know, scripture says to take our thoughts captive. Well, before we can even take our thoughts captive, we have to be able to notice what thoughts we're having to begin with. And so, I mean, even today, something, I was excited but also nervous to be up here. And so a mindfulness practice that I've been using this whole time has been sitting here, you know, noticing the chair, noticing my jeans, taking a deep breath in between each time to center myself and bring myself back to the moment. Mindfulness is really about grounding ourselves, connecting ourselves to our bodies and to the present moment. So that's a really great way to start exercising a muscle that we all have and we all really need.
That's so good. Thank you for that. We all got work to do this week, right? Some mindfulness. Doreen, last question. What are healthy rhythms every marriage should have for emotional and mental health?
So I intentionally started with what I call soul care and broke it down how I did, because it brings me to where I want to go now. When I sit with any relationship situation, I think of it as a capital H. I have an individual. How they connect is the dance of the relationship, okay? When I think of couples, through soul care, is I, building on what was just shared here, I encourage people to really check in with themselves even before they start their time with God, not only what they're thinking, what three top emotions would describe where you're at right now. I encourage some of them that are really working on this, I'd like journal it. I want you to see what pervasively comes up. It can be warm emotions, positive emotions, it can be distressing emotions. Whatever they are, what is it? So you have, what are you thinking about? What are you feeling? What are the emotions that are going on? What are the desires you have in your heart, good or bad, for God or against God? What things are you just dreaming about or fantasizing about? What is the will? What are you set in your heart to do? So when you do this with Jesus or the Holy Spirit and God in privacy, you then have that to share with your spouse. Now, it does mean your spouse has to be a safe person. If you're both doing that, you can have much richer conversations, because our conversations are only as rich as what we know our own self when it comes to personal intimacy with others. So that, when you say what do struggling spouses do, I think no matter what the other spouse is dealing with, both of you should be able to share from those points. So I encourage my couples, especially depending on what life, 30-year-olds are just really busy. You've got all the kids on the ground, the professions are demanding a lot, you have no time or space. So I at least say once a week, can you please find 20 minutes to connect on what is most important to you and your soul? And it could be from any one of those areas. So I just think, and no matter what age you are, whether you're young or whether you're in your golden years, continue to get to know each other. I have people, because I don't work with children, I could, but I don't. I have people away from 18 to probably 78. Couples coming in right now, they're still just growing and improving.
That's great. Last question. This is for the whole panel, so anyone can answer, or everyone can answer, is how can we be a community that really supports those going through grief or mental health challenges?
So, first I just wanted to say, like, it's really important to be like educated and to try to be open to learning. And so two things with that is, one, I have resources outside on the table about mental health first aid. And mental health first aid is you learn about signs and symptoms and ways to support people who are undergoing either addiction or mental health distress. So there's flyers out there to learn more about that. And then also just at baseline, you know, we teach our kids, everybody should know 911. Everybody should know, you know, if you're experiencing a crisis, if you're having, you know, you've hurt yourself, call 911, get the ambulance, get the police. There's a similar number for mental health crises, and that's 988. I also have resources out in the lobby on that for like, for anybody, for teens, like I have stickers with that, I have magnets, but it's just really important to have those two resources, well, have 988 especially like at our access.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make a plug for both.
And if you call that number, you're getting a professional that can help you? Is that my understanding?
Someone who's trained in crisis intervention.
Yeah, wow, that's great. Any other responses?
So I would absolutely second everything that Ashley is saying, that do not be afraid to ask for help. We have lots of resources out there. And if you are interested in being educated in, you know, a little bit more about how do I talk to people who might be going through a mental health crisis or even less than that, that they're just, you know, not feeling well, absolutely do that. Just a practical piece of advice that I would give everybody here is the one thing that I find almost always works is listening. So mm-hmm. if you are with somebody you love, or a friend, or even a stranger that you don't know, but it seems that they are going through something and not doing well, oftentimes just being an ear that listens and tries to hear and understand what they're going through, what's upsetting them, what's distressing them, even if you don't have the answers, just that connection of being somebody who wants to understand and wants to be a helpful person, that has a lot of value. And in my experience, you cannot go wrong with that. So
that's great. Yeah. So good.
And I'll just add one more thing, piggybacking on my colleagues here. My practice grew. I don't even have a website, so don't try to find me. I'm not on social media anymore, so don't try to find me there. Call pastors or whatever. My practice grew literally primarily through small groups, pastors, chiropractors, and friendship circles. Mm. Because they were sharing something, and they're like, oh my word, you gotta go see her. And sometimes I've had some people like, four people told me I needed to come to you. And so that what I'm saying is, when you don't know, go to your pastors, share with your friends.
Yeah.
Some of them in there have a little bit clearer sense, like, yeah, this is bigger than just probably what you're just going to breathe and pray and support your way through with the people you have. You might need a little additional support, just like with Pastor Josh has shared from two different stories of his own life.
Hmm.
When he had. So anyways, I just wanted to add that.
Yeah.
Listen to the people who love you and know you. If they're saying, yeah, get some extra support, probably take a step toward that.
That's great. Well, hey, this has been so helpful. We hope that you have found it super helpful. Can we give it up for our panel? Thank you, guys.